sometimes, you never have those moments where you just realize, oh, being alive is really weird. Like, you almost catch yourself when you get busy and you're like, I don't know, taxes, whatever, like you're late for something and you just get sucked into just like the, for lack of a better word, I guess, the rat race.
So if we don't know where our body is, how do we know where we are? It's such a big thing with the embodied movement, which I really push, embodied cognition. A brain does not function inside a black skull, dark, nothing going on, without inputs from the body, from the sense receptors, from everything that's going on in the environment. So our body is actually feeding up to our brain, but our experience of self. Do I move well? Do I feel creaky? Do I say, oh, my back's killing me? Or do I walk with a sense of power in my posture? And I love what you said there is, if you don't know the schema of your body, whether you're deadlifting or trying to be more confident, you're in trouble because you don't know where the right things are. How do we manage tension or apply tension appropriately in your experience?
Yeah, I think there's two questions there. One is, how do we do that? And then how do we apply it? So I think like one thing that I do all the time now, which I've just found to be the most effective approach, is give someone the experience of what they want and then teach them how they can keep or reproduce that experience. I think the more you learn about, again, the body, and it's funny how these things transcend culture. We know, for example, that your postural system is governed by your serotonergic system. And you can trace that system a third of a billion years back in the past, because you can look at certain animals and you can see how that same neurophysiological relationship governs their posture and also governs the level of serotonin.
What do you see in a body that you're also seeing in their life? Welcome to Mindset, Mood and Movement, a systemic approach to human behavior, performance and well-being. Hello and welcome. Today I'm joined by my guest Tom Waldron, who is a movement specialist. He works with biomechanics and all cool things with the body. Now, this is really interesting because Tom shares an interest in the body like I do, but in a much more detailed way. But we were talking recently and I was absolutely intrigued with his work about how working with the body changes how we experience life and do things in life. We're going to get into this. But a big thing is, if you've got a lot of challenges going on mentally, getting into the body is going to be a massive, massive benefit for you. So we shall unpack. Tom, welcome to the show. It's good to see you, mate.
Thanks for having me, Sal. Thank you.
Cool. Okay, so give us a little context around, what do you do that's different with people that's movement orientated that really helps them connect with their body?
I would say probably with that, the main thing, and you could even say this is the difference between potentially an instructor and a coach, is just initially finding out why the person has come to see you in the first place. And that's definitely not unique to me by any means. A good therapist will do that, or a good clinician will do that. But I suppose the first thing is finding out what that person's goals are, because that's the most important thing. And then respectfully, with my background, if I feel like, you know what, you would benefit from this a bit more or benefit from this a bit more, we can have that discussion and then move forward with some interventions that would help with that as well, if that makes sense. A bit of what they want and then a bit of what I think they also need.
Yeah, really nice. That's a nice way of kind of meeting the middle, isn't it? Figuring out what that person's requirements are, what their pain points are, and understanding their version of the world, plus your knowledge overlaying, which is really, really nice. It's so interesting about body stuff. I'm an S&C trainer as well now, as a psychotherapist, as a mindset coach. And the more I work with my own physiology, my own body, and the more I work with other people's, the more I see that if we are looking at human performance, if we're looking at mental being and emotional well-being, we really, really want to be including the body. And it's often been a secondary thing, hasn't it? That I'll do a workout after work, or I'm too busy to exercise. And I would say, actually, there's so much data and knowledge now that says, if you're not exercising, if you're not physically well, your business isn't going to go well. Your health is probably going to be damaged in some way, and your relationships are impacted. So it has this whole kind of cascade of influence, doesn't it? Whether it's negative or positive. Mm. Now, what are you seeing when someone comes to you with a problem? I can only imagine they come, I've got a sore shoulder, or my back's killing me. One of the classics. What do you see in a body that you're also seeing in their life? What do you notice in those parallels?
Yeah, I think one of the things can definitely be, let's say, if we're just talking about pain for a moment, I think at this point, if you're not addressing any psychosomatic or lifestyle aspects to someone's pain problem, doesn't really matter where the pain actually is, then you're probably on some level not finishing the job. So I think one thing that's always good is you're always trying to maintain some form of retention and motivation with people. So obviously, if someone comes in with a painful shoulder, one of the first things you want to do is try and reduce or minimize the symptoms so they get what they want. And then along the way, you also might help them with what they need to make those positive changes longer lasting. So for example, I guess a more obvious example from my experience has been lower back pain. So one of probably the second or third question I'll ask someone these days is, how's your sleep these days? How are you sleeping? So quality of sleep and also quantity. I'm definitely not a sleep expert. I've listened to people who are sleep experts, but there's definitely enough research to convince me that, yeah, if someone is underslept, that's going to really ramp up their amygdala and that's going to increase their pain sensitivity. Not that they're sensitive as a person, just literally the sensitivity of the nervous system. And so addressing things like rest is also really important. I used to say tension. I'm always changing my dialogue around tension. I used to think tension was bad, but tension means many things. You could talk about the tension of the connective tissue, or you can talk about literal psychological tension. And so I think of that, maybe physiologically, we're also fine-tuning the tension on a level, whether that's actually reducing or increasing tension in certain areas. And I think that does have a direct influence on their psychology as well, how they feel about their back afterwards.
Yeah, that's cool, isn't it? I understand about tensional forces, having taught yoga for many years, got into different gyms, learned about heavy lifting, learned about torque, as in T-O-R-Q-U-E, so how to create torque in the body and tension. And tensional forces in the body are appropriate. So if you are going to do a deadlift and you've got no core activation, no glutes really working, you're probably going to load your rectors, you're going to damage your lower back, you're going to have problems. Application of tension, I think, is really skillful, both in the gym, in the boardroom, and perhaps in life, because if we aren't reflexive enough, then we can either be a soft, gentle individual, or we're too hard and too edgy. And I find this way of being in the 21st century that if we are able to flex, we've got really good things and skills available to us. There's a time to stand up to someone, and there's a time to be gentle. And we want to know where and how. And I think the body is such a good physical experience of this. Am I holding tension in my shoulders because I'm just stressed to hell with what's going on? Or am I creating tension in my chest muscles because I'm about to do a chest press? So I think this conscious, deliberate application of tension is a really skillful art. Then the question goes, how does a person do that? I ask people, say to me, so how do we do that? That's always the figure out question. So how do people, how do our bodies, how do we manage tension or apply tension appropriately in your experience?
Yeah, I think there's two questions. There's one is, how do we do that? And then how do we apply it? So I think like one thing that I do all the time now, which I've just found to be the most effective approach, is give someone the experience of what they want, and then teach them how they can keep or reproduce that experience. So I think back in the day, I would very much be like, okay, so it's this and this, and you explain the thing. And it might be right, it probably was wrong sometimes as well. But the idea is, it doesn't really mean anything unless someone has a literal experience in their nervous system of what it feels like, for example, to have a quote unquote tension-free shoulder. And then you can give them the steps on how they can recreate that experience. So it's funny, again, language is interesting how we use language. So I even just said tension-free shoulder. And in reality, you're never tension-free. So the collagen fibers that are in the matrix of certain connective tissues, they're always under tension. Even if you're quote-unquote relaxed, there's still a level of tension there. They're never under slack. So if you want to actually have the experience of not feeling tension, it's about fine-tuning the right level of tension for your body in that moment. And so, for example, that would be, then how would you get to the practical aspect of that? Sometimes people have these preconceived ideas that, oh, before I do this movement, I have to pre-activate this muscle. Or when I'm doing the movement, I have to keep these muscles short and these ones long. And the issue of that is, obviously, if you're going to move the body, things have to change. So you have to have different neurological impulses. You need to have different, literally different levels of tension going through your connective tissue. And then you have different muscle cells going on and off as well. So I think on that level, it's also addressing, are there any preconceived ideas about the body that this person might have, either if they're also a professional and they've been taught a certain way, or if they've gone to certain classes and they've just been taught you can't lift your leg until you brace your core first, for example. And I think they're not bad things. You're not going to break someone if you teach them that. but you might be reinforcing patterns of excessive tension over time. To then they get to the point in present day where they feel like they can't move their shoulder a certain way, or they can, but it just feels uncomfortable. My big thing is always starting with what's the experience you want? And then it's doing a few, sometimes it's essentially like little magic tricks to give them that experience. That experience is inherently always going to be temporary because most short-term change is neurologically driven anyway. But then how can you give someone the tools so then they can build that experience for themselves long-term? Am I making sense, or am I just rambling?
Yeah, that's really, really good. I'm quite metaphorically driven. My mind sees things in metaphors, and I'm imagining a violinist or a guitar player. Now, I've never played either, but I've seen them. And they're really cool when they're strung nicely. So I can imagine looking at the strings of a guitar or a violin, and if they are loose, you can try and pluck them, that it's going to make no sound, or it's going to be terrible. Or if they're too tight, you pluck them and it could break. Same with a tennis racket, if that's a better metaphor for someone. Floppy strings, the ball is going to be all over the place. Too hard, and you might get too much bounce. In terms of tensional forces, I love what you've said there. Create the experience that you want, and I'm interested to get an example of that in a second, but then give them the tools. Because to keep it very physiological for this moment, in the S&C domain, there is still a large contingent that you really brace your core very strongly, say doing a heavy squat or a heavy deadlift or pushing a heavy sled, something like that. And I know some people in the other movement field who challenge that. They don't say you don't brace your core, but they say you're relaxed under tension. And there are these opposing, in a way, ideologies. But if we think about practical, you don't generally tense your body to lift something up. You simply lift it up. So I guess the sweet spot is, how do we get to a place where it's so unconsciously elegant that our body works without becoming unsafe? So can you give me an example? Let's take a deadlift. So any of my listeners who go to the gym and pick some stuff up in a deadlift move, we all know it. You want to protect your back. You want to hinge nicely. How might you help that person have a better experience rather than locked on tension, or they're too floppy and potentially damage themselves? How could you take us through that example of experience and then a tool to work with them?
Yeah, so that's a really good, I like that exercise. So a really good way that I use for myself and also for a lot of clients is, so let's say the goal is I want to pick that weight off the floor in whichever form they want to do it, whether they want to hip hinge more or they want to feel like they're just more stable. One of the first things I'll do is literally give them an experience, which you can do very easily, of where actually are your hip joints located. So in your body, where does the femur head actually meet your acetabulum? And it doesn't mean you suddenly got to go into this big anatomy class and here's the thing and the thing and here are all the ligaments. It's not so much that. It's literally just, do you even know where your joints are located in your body? And the hip joints are normally a really good example of that, because even with professionals, if you ask them, like, take your index fingers and point on your body, where are your hip joints? People almost inevitably either point to their ASIs, so their hip bones, or they point to their greater trochanters.
Greater trochanter, yeah.
Either too high or too out to the side. And what's really interesting about that is when you ask someone a question, like, again, where's your shoulder, where's your spine, where's your hip joints, and then they point to where they think it is, they're already giving you a clue of what their body schema is. So it's like, my perception of where my thigh bone meets my pelvic bone is here, whether it's accurate or not accurate. So one of the first things I'll do, it takes 30 seconds, is I'll just give them, and I don't even touch them, I can tell them how to find their hip joints. And then once they've actually located, oh, my hip joints are here, they're actually usually much more narrow and central to the body than what I may have thought they were before. And then I'll get them just to move their hip joints from that position. And for many people, if that's the first time they've actually had a cognitive, clear understanding of, oh, well, okay, my femur head's actually here, and that's the place I primarily want to be moving from if I want to be picking the bar off the floor, that, without me having to give any cues or any sort of instruction, it instantly changes how they organize themselves. And one of the things that I'm really into, and I'm not above in any way giving cues or giving clear instructions, but what I just find really interesting is if you give the brain a clear, simplistic sense of, oh, okay, here is said bone or said joint, it instantly organizes itself in a quote unquote better way, in a more efficient way, or in the way that person wants to be organized. So then when they do the movement, they're like, oh, okay, cool. And then even then, you can still give cues afterwards. I can still say, oh, imagine that you're dropping your pelvis down onto a chair or anything like that, some sort of external cue. But I always start with, let's just change your experience of your body. And a good place to start is fundamentally, if you don't know where a joint is, something simple like a hip joint, how do you know if you're moving it properly or even moving it potentially at all? Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I love that. Understanding the schema of the body, yeah, where it is. And this is a thing I see in human performance work, whether we're in the physical domain or the psychological or emotional domain, that if you don't know what's going on, it's really hard to deal with it because it's an abstraction. Yeah, it's like, oh, I'm really stressed. What does that even mean? Or I'm struggling with my deadlift. What does that actually mean? We need to get specific and we need to be accurate. Because if you're not deadlifting or hinging, as of course the deadlift movement is, from the right place, you'll hinge from another place, which implicitly might be a physiological or physical problem. And I would also say psychologically, because as I explained to you, Tom, and all my regular listeners know, there is such a crossover between our thinking, feeling self and our physical moving self. And one is influencing the other all the time. So if we don't know where our body is, how do we know where we are? It's such a big thing with the embodied movement, which I really push, embodied cognition. A brain does not function inside a black skull, dark, nothing going on, without inputs from the body, from the sense receptors, from everything that's going on in the environment. So our body is actually feeding up to our brain, and then it's a longer debate about what the brain and mind is, but but our experience of self. Do I move well? Do I feel creaky? Do I say, oh, my back's killing me? Or do I walk with a sense of power in my posture? And I love what you said there is, if you don't know the schema of your body, whether you're deadlifting or trying to be more confident, you're in trouble because you don't know where the right things are. So that's super, super helpful. Yeah, really helpful. Thank you.
Yes, I was going to say of that as well. It's almost like that's a really nice way of putting it. I think like it's also fundamentally, if you're helping someone move better, it's just about really helping them relate to the environment better. So you're relating to the chair better, you're relating to the floor, you're relating to that bar that you want to pick up. So it's very much, I've got this physical thing and it's made up of many different types of tissues and the geometry changes all over the place. But if I've just got a simple sense of, oh, okay, this is a point, like, okay, let's say the hip joint, this is a point where there's lots of power, and it's also a point with lots of movement. If I just have a little bit more of a kinesthetic awareness of where that area is, that instantly just changes how you relate to, one, that internal place, being the hip joint, but also then the external world, like just the floor and how you place your feet on the floor. That for me has always been really interesting, like trying to almost teach a little bit less sometimes and just be like, this is what your brain needs to know. Here's your hip joint or here's your knee. And then does that change how you position your body in space?
Very nice. Yeah. A very good coaching approach, right? To help the person generate the understanding from within. And when we generate learning from within, it's implicit. We own it. It's a great way. I love that. Such a great definition. Now, we were speaking a little bit before the show about forces, and I really want to get your knowledge on this. Forces are at play everywhere. And you explained to me there's, of course, there's gravity. There's all kinds of physiological forces, and we'll dig into that. But of course, Tom, there are forces in life. Now, there's pressure. There is stresses. There are social challenges. There's financial challenges. And if we want to be a well-functioning human being, we want to relate to those forces well because they're not going to go away. So how do we relate to them? How do we work with them? Now, perhaps you can give me some of your understanding about working with forces, both from the body and then how that plays out into that person's experience. How do you work with that? Can you say some more?
Yeah, I think it's always just good to know what are the forces in the first place. And then from there, sometimes those answers almost become obvious. So you have four main forces of movement, which would be gravity, the weight of your body, momentum, so how fast you're moving your body, and then it's the reaction from the ground, so ground reaction force. So whether you're a yogi, a Pilates teacher, gyrotonic instructor, runner, it's non-negotiable. Those are the four forces that you deal with for the rest of your life. So how well you deal with those forces on a fundamental level dictates the experience of your whole life. So I would say it's interesting that you think of what makes up a human's life. You could say many things, but I think one of the main components is you're always standing, or you're almost always standing, you're sitting, your breathing and your thinking. How are you managing those experiences? When you stand, can you organize yourself in a way which is unique to your own body? It's not to say here's a cookie cutter way everyone should stand, but for your own just physiological makeup, can you stand in a way where you're actually managing those four forces in a way that feels good to you or feels comfortable to you? And then even to the sense of, let's say, more the thinking. So we know that, for example, the thoughts in your head literally have a physiological influence on your body. So we know very clearly now, for example, that if you are visualizing a movement, very similar parts of the brain become active as if you were doing that movement. And then you even get a little bit of a trickle-down effect where you get neurological womps going into like certain muscle fibers and as if you were doing that movement. So you literally have this neurological crossover between what you do and also how you think or how you visualize things. So I think on a level, it's been my experience that how you navigate through the world, so how gracefully or non-gracefully you deal with those forces, that has a huge impact on how you deal with social aspects or, again, interpersonal things like relationships as well, for sure. It's been my experience doing it, definitely. And it's been fun to also get similar sort of feedback from clients without prompting them. Where I think I was saying to you before the podcast, let's say you help someone with their back pain. Sometimes helping someone with their back pain is things like, I'm not going to teach them about the forces necessarily, but can we move you in a way and maybe strengthen certain things in a way so you're just managing the forces of movement better? And then that can totally translate into them being more socially comfortable at going to certain social functions, for example. And I do think those bridges are quite connected.
Yeah, I see that too. Certainly if someone steps into my coaching space, and which is largely a conversation, a psychological, let's say, working domain, but I'll always reference the body. What's going on with your body as you say this? So we have an embodied connection around this. And what intrigues me is about movement. I've often sat with a coffee and just watched people go by. I find it absolutely intriguing. You can read a lot without mind reading or assumptions, but you can read a lot. There's a lot of information available if you're quiet and you observe. And it might be, how does someone's gait? How are they moving? Where's their eye line? Are they looking down? Are they looking up? And these things say a lot about where that person's at. And I know for me, it's that I learned this years ago, but every time I'm very much buried in thinking, binge thinking, I call it, I'll be looking down. I'll be slightly collapsing the thoracic area. I'll be slightly loading my lower back. I just won't be walking very well. And as soon as I can feel that roll across the foot, and the lift in my core, an eye line forward or up, I'm in a much more open mind space. And this really intrigues me. This posture is power. I learned this many years ago in yoga. I learned this from being a photographer, as one of my other careers that I did. How we move, how we stand is experienced by us and the other. So if we want to be functioning well, the best that we can be, and we're not attending to these forces and to the way we relate to these forces, both A, that's a problem, and B, that's an opportunity. Problems and opportunities go together. It depends what you're doing about them. So if I was to come to you, Tom, I'm like, okay, all my lower back's really tricky and I've got a lot of stresses going on right now and, you know, I'm a bit wonky. You've already said you kind of ask questions, which is great. You figure out what that person wants. But let's say I said to you, listen, I just want to feel good. I want to get rid of this achy back. I'd like to be a little less stressed, please. That'd be great if you know how to do that. What would you do? Does in the physical domain, in your toolbox, that would treat that kind of challenge, which you would know not only treats the quote-unquote back problem and the stress level, but would have a direct effect on that person's experience emotionally and psychologically as well?
Yeah, absolutely. To keep it to lower back pain, the first thing, once they've been clinically cleared, the first thing I would be checking is I would ask them, can you either show me or can you explain to me? So what movements, postures, or just daily life activities has your lower back affected, basically? So what can you currently not do or not do at all? And normally they can like demonstrate on a level, like whether it's bending forward or if it's picking up like their three-year-old. And then it's just kind of like noticing that, like, just first of all, just the external. Okay, they suffer with maybe squatting, or they have an issue with bending to the left or whatever it is. And then when they get more into the daily life things, like normally it's a lot of guys who may not be able to play with their three-year-old for very long because they simply can't bend down and stay in that position for a long time. So already there's an emotional component there for sure. Whether they're aware of it or not, that's like really, really powerful. So my first point of call is, let's find a way for you to do those movements where either we're minimizing the level of discomfort, or hopefully, even quite initially, there's not any discomfort there. And the reason why we're doing that, from my perspective, one is it's to keep that person having their autonomy so they can actually still live the life they want to live and they're not feeling like they're broken or they constantly do things. And it's also exposing the body to similar movements that they currently can't do for whatever reason, but finding a way to work around it. And that normally calms down, if they have any stress around it, that normally calms down their stress levels too. So if they can't bend forwards and play with their toddler just yet, maybe they can bend down 75% of the way. And if we just play with where the legs are positioned, maybe the leg is going to be a bit more further forward than it originally was. So you've got to bend your spine forward as far. Then they can play with their kid for a bit longer, for example. So rather than trying to take away movements or take away exercises, just reverse engineer it and modify it to the point where they can manage it. And then over time, it's building them back up again so that they can actually manage those positions. So I guess just to summarize, first thing is, what can you not do? Okay, cool. Let's now modify that so you can do it to a certain degree. And then around that, looking at the movements that they showed, okay, let's now increase your tolerance in those positions. So as you were saying, if it is, let's say, they can't bend their spine forward because that starts to hurt, that could be because they simply aren't strong enough in spinal flexion for the loads they're currently dealing with. So let's do some spinal flexion, but let's just maybe do it in a different way until they can do it in the way they couldn't do it before. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. It's really, really nice, isn't it? Because there's a tendency to think, if I have an injury or have a pain, I won't go there. I won't bend over, or I won't do the movement that causes me discomfort. And yet what you're suggesting there is, let's understand that better. Let's have a different relationship to that. Let's perhaps get an experience of that in a slightly different version or a different amount. And what I hear there is you're actually giving someone back freedom, physical freedom to move, or maybe to play with a kid or whatever it is. But you're giving that person back autonomy as opposed to a disability, which obviously it's a strong word and we're careful how we use it. But if you're unable to do something, you start to become moving towards disability. And it's something which intrigues me as someone of some mature years now. As I look to the future and you look to the stats, you're like, muscle loss 3% per year, muscle power loss 3%. And you look at the stats generally and think, okay, if I don't stay active, and I am super active, and I preach this, I'm like, look, if you're 40 plus, you need to be training. And I've had people say to me, I'm not an athlete. I'm like, yeah, but you need to be, because life demands us to be an athlete, because we have chairs. If we're knowledge workers, we sit at chairs, we sit at computers, and we might drive or take a bus or whatever. We are so damn sedentary now. Just lifestyle is so sedentary that if we don't do something to arrest that sedentary dynamic, then we're going to have problems. And of course, that's something which I do myself, and I also aim to get clients to do more and more. As we're getting towards a more mature year, there used to be the sentiment that you should slow it down, didn't they? Just take it easy. I remember one of my clients, he was a ex-kickboxer, and then he came to my yoga practice. And it's funny because I went from yoga and I've got into boxing now. I've gone the other way. I've gone the extreme stuff. But there is a prevailing worldview, certainly in our country or in the West, that as we age, we have this certain expectation of less mobility, less strength, probably diminished health, and all these qualities. Now, while it's true to some degree that the body will diminish slowly over time if it's kept well, I'm really interested in challenging this orthodoxy about saying to people, no, you can relearn a movement pattern at 45 years old. You can become a strong woman or strong man at 57. It's all there. But how would you treat that? Let's say I come to you, Tom, and I'm like, listen, I've seen your stuff. You sound so cool. I'm ready. I'm 50. What am I? 52 now. I'm 52. I want to be an athlete. Help me. I saw Sal. He said, go to see you. What would you do? How would you help a person who's roughly midlife say, let's get you moving well, so you're functioning well physiologically, you're functioning well in your movement, and you're functioning well in your health? What would you do? I know I've thrown actually a massive challenge at you. That's but I'm fine. Really intrigued to how you might take that on.
Well, it's interesting. So I would say probably, temperamentally, I'm a relatively optimistic person. However, I do believe that negative emotion can be much more powerful if used in a certain context in this sort of situation. So, for example, we know that if you put a mouse on a little treadmill and you have the smell of cheese at the end of the treadmill, the mice is, or the mouse is going to be motivated to run on the treadmill faster to get the food, basically. However, if you put the smell of a cat behind them, they run much faster than they were to block the cheese, because it's more the idea of they're more motivated to not get eaten than they are to get a reward. So even though it is very motivational to have, obviously, goals, end state goals, process goals, like, you know where you want to be going. So I think mapping out what you want is important. But I actually think, to be real, sometimes it's really good to just spend an hour fully articulating what would be like your own version of hell in 5 years. So what would it be like? So I would look like this, or I'd feel this way, or this would happen. And you go through that as a bit of a process. If the next 5 years went terribly, what would that look like? And then that gives you the blueprint of, I want to go in the opposite direction of that, basically. And I think that's when you can sometimes motivate people. So if you want to have a body that wears down really fast, you're going to get really ill, you always feel like crap, you can't do anything, and actually you're kind of like a bit of a bummer to hang out with because you don't really want to do anything and you can't anyway. And I just think sometimes articulating the reality of that, that can motivate someone to be like, you know what, okay, that's, so what do I do to avoid that? And it's, okay, walking's really good, strength training's really good, flexibility, maybe, whatever, just basically, as long as you do strength training, actually you're going to get more flexible anyway. Even though it starts negative, that kind of gets the fire going. And I also think it's also, like you were saying, that the preconceived ideas that you're meant to be feeling this way at this age, or you're meant to be looking this way at this age, or you shouldn't be doing that at this time of your life, whatever. I think one of the ways you can minimize those negative beliefs, which aren't even accurate in the first place, is people believe they have to like work out 7 times a week and they've got to do like a 90-minute session and they've got to do this, this and that. When in the reality, if someone does like a workout session 3 times a week for 45 minutes and they're doing like, let's say, a strength program, the benefits are non-linear. They're going to keep getting better and better and better as long as the program is progressing with them. And it doesn't have to be like these 7 hours a week slog, basically. So I think it's also realizing the bar can be set quite low for success, but also maybe know where you could go if you never even started in the first place. Does that make sense?
It does. I love that. I really love that. I'm quite happy at staring into the abyss sometimes to motivate me. And as we, certainly I know from brain science that the brain is a prediction system. Professor Andy Clark talks about this, the predictive brain, that the brain is always predicting. And the first thing it's always looking for, or brain/nervous system, is threat. We are threat detection system first and foremost. And when the threat's out of the way, then we can be socially engaged, what we call dorsal vagal on the nervous system. There are two types. So I come across away from meta patterns, they're called, and toward meta patterns. So overarching thinking styles for people. I think both are really powerful. I think let's look how bad it could really be. Actually, if you don't do something, this is where your life is going to end up. And that's not a good look. And this is where it could be. And then you got that. And what I'm feeling, there's tension, right? That creates tension. And you spoke about tensional forces in the body. And I'm interested in that tensional forces in motivation, or let's say compulsion, around if you can notice these two things, that might create the right kind of tension. But yeah, I love that. I would be listening to you harshly. I'd be like, yeah, totally. I know where I don't want to be in 5 years. And I have an autoimmune condition. So I know what it's like to be down and out, to be broken by it. And I'm in pretty good shape and I have to be careful. There are certain things I need to do and not do. But I know having health taken away from you is suffering, pure suffering. And I don't wish it on anyone. And I certainly don't want it for myself. But that's why I do what I do. It's one of the big motivations, because I know what suffering feels like and I don't want that. So because people say to me, Tom, they're like, wow, you're so motivated. You train every day. You do this. I'm like, yeah, but I see it as play. And I also see it as privilege, because I know when I haven't been able to even stand up, I can't even stand up. So when I can stand up, I'm never not grateful for that. I don't know. If someone's had a health issue, maybe they relate to that. But maybe if you haven't, it could be more challenging.
I think I really believe it's a privilege to be able to have your autonomy. Like truly, my first ever client ever was a 13-year-old boy. And I'm still friends with him now. He's about 27 now, something. But anyway, he had cerebral palsy. He was born with cerebral palsy. And so he couldn't walk. And I was working with him because he was having some surgeries at the time. And my job, I mean, I barely knew anything at this point, but my job was to come in for 2 hours a day and just do some stretches. And it was really, really positive. But I remember I was probably like 18 at the time. I was really young. And I remember just being in bed one night. It's probably quite early on when I was working with this young guy. And I remember just being like, at any point, if I want to go to the toilet, I can just get up and go to the loo. Or like glass of water. I mean, I really just spent like a few minutes in like darkness, like in my bedroom, just thinking about this. And then, because it was the first time in my life I'd been around someone who was disabled, physically disabled, basically. And it was really, it was almost like a light bulb moment went off. I was just like, it is a genuine privilege to be able to just even like me gesture with my hand as I'm talking. And I think sometimes you never have those moments where you just realize, oh, being alive is really weird. Like you almost catch yourself because you get busy every day and you're like, I don't know, taxes, whatever, like you're late for something and you just get sucked into just like the, for lack of a better word, I guess, the rat race. And then you have this moment which is like, it's really weird that I'm alive. And it's 80 years of, it's just like, sometimes I have those moments, I just get quite introspective. But I just think also it's really lucky to, one, be alive, but also you're alive with a body that actually is able to respond to like your thinking.
Yeah.
And just, I sometimes have these funny debates with friends who I might say that to them and they're just like, what are you on about, mate? Of course you can move. They think it's ridiculous that I'm just grateful on that level that you're able to move your body.
Yeah.
But I think maybe if you've been around that a little bit, you've been around people that don't have that and they weren't even born with that opportunity in the first place. It's just, it's almost, and I think as well, talking to older men, guys in their 70s and 80s, who are still really fit and active, but they can sometimes say still, bloody, it's harder now.
Yeah.
And I just think it's good to keep it if you've got it.
Yeah, absolutely. A phrase came to my mind a little while ago. It's a bit of the Cartesian debate, but we don't live in a body. We live through a body. So that means if your whole experience of life is mediated through your senses, through your tissues, through your fascia, up through the nervous system into the brain, into to the idea of like, how am I doing today? How am I feeling? How am I moving? How am I working? Then I think we are missing the absolute building blocks of the conduit of like how our experience actually is. So we could go deep and philosophical, which is where I like to hang out, but I'm going to bring it back on point. So for our listeners, we've really checked in with some important stuff. Understanding forces, understanding tension, understanding that relationship between your body and really knowing where things are. That's just such fundamental and clear advice. It's brilliant, Tom. It's really brilliant. I would like to capture this into some of the pillars or the key things. You might say, here's what I would impart if you want to function well. What might those pillars or guidance points be?
I would say just know how the body functions. So if you want to know, okay, like how do I function better? I think the thing before that is, what is the function of this thing? So if that makes any sense. So for example, bring it back to practical again. So what's the function of your foot, right? Let's say. So your foot, to keep it simple, it can be a very foundational, stable surface to help balance the whole body. And then it can also be a narrow, rigid lever that can propel you through space. So on a level, and there's obviously many functions like balance, proprioception, but just on that basic mechanical level, the function of the foot is to give you a foundational surface. And then it's to give you a much less foundational surface in a few milliseconds to push you away from the floor. So if you want to have a functional foot, make sure it can just do those two things. And then to work it back a bit further, so how does it do those two things? You need to have a pronated foot sometimes, and then you need to have a supinated foot. So just then do exercises that complement the different movements that create pronation and create supination. And if you do that, you'll have a functional foot. For example, so I think it's like just knowing what the function of something is, you can already then streamline, oh, okay, that's how I'm functional, then I can do that. And then obviously you can be more specific. I think there's, in my mind, the function has two definitions. You have the function of the body. So what's the function of this organ, like the spine, the rib cage, whatever. And then can I base some of my exercises around complementing those functions? But then also you have personal functions. For example, going back to the guy earlier on who wants to play with his kid and he wants to bend down, that's a function. Mm. So it's also then, and that might be then more global. So then how do I get the hips to move better? How do I get the spine to move better to accommodate that function that person wants in their personal life with their kid, for example? So for me, it's always been that. It just goes back to going much more global now. Like what's the function of the human body? One thing we're really, really good at is walking. We're the best walkers on the planet. So why not just learn a little bit about what creates walking? Or like another one, if you want to have a better shoulder, if you want your shoulder to feel just pain-free, stronger, more flexible, better positioned, why do you have a shoulder? Your shoulder is basically a force buffer between your spine and your hand so you can throw balls. So you can throw rocks or throw spears. So we're the best throwers on the planet. So we know, for example, that by the time you get to four, a four-year-old Homo sapiens, human, is already a better thrower than a chimp, than a fully grown chimpanzee. So we're really designed for throwing stuff. So if that's like your evolution heritage, walking, throwing, a bit of swimming, aquatic as well, oddly enough, then why not just do things on a regular basis that you were designed to do anyway? And that will probably go a long way to improving your function.
Really nice.
Did I answer the question?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, my mind's percolating that principle, and I trust those listening as well are doing the same. But yeah, just in some ways, it's super practical, isn't it? Like, what is the function of my foot? What does it actually do? And if you've got back pain, is that because you walk in a dysfunctional way? And it could be for some people.
Yeah.
If so, we change the function of the foot and the global idea of I want to travel whilst walking, then we might then release up the chain of events. Actually, my position of my hips is better now because my foot's better. And suddenly my lower back pain is gone, which then also means that I'm probably not miserable and it might not interrupt my sleep and so on and so forth. So they're called fractals. I call them fractals. You know what fractals are? So fractals are repeating patterns in nature.
Right.
We
right.
see them in the bronchioli of the lungs. We see them in the leaves and the trees. But I see like behavioral fractals in people as well, like the small pattern repeats into the bigger. And whether that's in the physical domain or psychological, but the pattern repeats, whether that's imbalance or incorrect tension or misunderstanding or even disconnection from the body, which I think is the biggest thing I see for some people, that the thinking self and the somatic self, the body self, are out of whack. They're out of harmony. And I love what you said there right at the early part of the show about get someone to know where their hip bones actually insert and they're going to hinge well. And of course, I'm like, yeah, that makes so much sense. And I'm thinking, when I was deadlifting the other day, was I paying attention to my hips? So I'm doing that. Deadlifts are on my schedule tomorrow. So I should be paying attention to the hip joint movement.
And then also for me, it becomes really fun. I really love anatomy. I just really enjoy the study of anatomy. Not because I like to remember abstract names of things. It's because I just feel like, when I'm learning anatomy, I'm learning about, I'm learning about myself. This is actually how I evolved. That's why the hip bones over there. That's why the sit bones over there. Okay. And I just find that gives me a really deep appreciation of movement. But then bringing it back to the clients, it doesn't mean that they've got to bloody know every single anatomy detail. But even going back to the throwing idea, I get my clients sometimes who I teach online, I get them to get a ball and we're just practicing throwing the ball. And we make it fun. You've got to visualize your partner and you're trying to throw the ball at them or just like a bullseye 100 meters away. But just that act of them throwing is so good for their shoulder. And as you say, if suddenly they're like, if they notice in their own body, which is always the more powerful teaching moment, is if they notice, they're like, you know what? My shoulder actually doesn't feel like it's moving so well on the right side than the left side. It might be something to do if the head's really far forward, that restricts shoulder movement. And so then you can be like, you know what? Why don't you just try this with your head? And then see if that improves how your shoulder moves. And then suddenly you've indirectly taught someone how the body's inherently connected. And it's not to say that everyone should have the same posture or everyone should look the same, and not at all. But going back to almost this idea of the tension of the neck and how the tension of the neck influences the tension of the shoulder, you can play with that relationship until someone feels like they're in their most optimal organizational alignment.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I'm going to summarize with, Tai Chi master friend, and they used to say about wasted energy. So from the Eastern arts, and they would look at a body composition and position, and they might get someone to move their upper shoulders a little bit, move their pelvis, spread the feet. And they would talk about how much energy is either wasted or saved based on optimal alignment. And as you rightly say, it's not you should look like this picture. You should stand like this, but it should be, do you feel balanced perhaps in the foot joints, the pelvis and the lower back and all these kind of positions? And it's amazing because energy is everything. Metabolic energy, thinking energy, oxygen, all energy is life. It's basic quantum physics and we mostly know this. And when anyone feels tired, and I see this a lot, someone's tired, exhausted, maybe burnt out, you are not utilizing your energy very well. And I think it's such an interesting thing to go to the physical energy as well. Like, how do you organize your body, as you've already beautifully alluded to? And is that disorganized? Are you essentially hemorrhaging energy through tight shoulders, traps that are overfiring, whatever that might be? And does that bleed out into the rest of your life? Energy drains, it's called in S&C. And I think it's such an important thing that a lot of people aren't looking at. And it is wasted energy. I would like to get your last thoughts on energy management, because it's something I talk about a lot with my people. Rather than time management, energy management, like going with biorhythms, going with the natural states. How might you work with that?
Yeah, I'm just thinking energy, because it's obviously a big thing. Like, the first thing that just comes to my head is sleep. I think that's probably because I'm thinking about my own energy management probably. I just noticed that if I'm underslept, it just throws everything out, which I find interesting. So I think in terms of how I work with people with energy management, just think about that for a minute. I suppose my main domain, which I do that in, would be in movement itself. So like you say, like, how can we better organize the ribs over the pelvis and how they rotate with each other in walking? And again, another way of saying energy management, you could say, is energy leakage, yeah. Which is more of a biomechanical term. If you're moving too much in the coronal plane, then you're wasting a bit of energy in the coronal plane. So can we minimize that? So we, as you were saying, optimizing their energy flow. And I think, you know, I've not seen her actually yet in a few months, but I'm going to work with her again soon. I have an energy coach. She doesn't really call herself an energy coach, but there's no other way I can explain it. So I just call her an energy coach. But that's very much working with energy, really. So we're working with my own energy. If there's any kind of energetic, like, areas that aren't letting go, which might manifest in like an image in my head or like an emotion or anything like that. And a lot of that, to be honest, is presence work. A lot of that I've learned from like Eckhart Tolle, which I'm a big fan of. And so in terms of energy management, sometimes it's just even noticing where you might have mismanagement, and even just that noticing, I'm out of my area of expertise now, but from what I've learned from my teachers is, even just by noticing that energy, it can already start to diminish if it's not managed well. And then you can start to manage it better just by being aware of it. But I think on a practical level for me, it's just sleep these days, like making sure that you have a relatively dark room, actually getting 8 hours rather than 6.5 or 5 hours. Because we know as well, like even with sleep, there's a fair bit of research now correlating lack of sleep to increase in injury risk. And so that's a huge thing as well with, how you move your body and how you manage it.
Yeah, fantastic. Yes, and sleep is a whole other field and probably for a whole other podcast, because it's a big topic. But yes, but I think the basics remain. You don't have to be a specialist in sleep to know what good sleep feels like and what disrupted sleep feels like and its effects. So yes, it just goes to reminding that if you get the basics right, the fundamentals right, you build your base, most things above it don't fall down. If you've got a terribly bad base, like physiologically or sleep, or your psychological base is all over the place, everything above it can crumble. Or often I talk about a core, because I'm looking at that from an Eastern principle, from a center out. If your core is robust and strong, everything that anchors and gravitates towards it will feel strong. Whereas if your core is weak, whether that's physical, whether or mental or emotional, then you're going to have problems. And I don't know many people that like problems. So we're always trying to overcome problems, right?
It's so funny, isn't it? Because I've sometimes been guilty of like calling these things woo-woo, and I do it with a bit of tongue in cheek. I don't really mean it. But it's funny because the more you learn about, again, the body, and it's funny how these things transcend culture. We know, for example, that your postural system is governed by your serotonergic system. And you can trace that system 1/3 of a billion years back in the past, because you can look at certain animals and you can see how that same neurophysiological relationship governs their posture and also governs the level of serotonin. And so these systems have been in place, they're like older than trees, they've been in place for a really, really, really long time. And I think, so it's just fun to learn these things, and it's almost like you're learning certain principles as well. And then being able to practically implement that in an S&C class, or if it's a Pilates class or whatever it is, an education forum. I think it's just on many different levels, it's quite a rewarding thing to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, I am delighted that we got to speak today. I'm better informed already. I'm so privileged that I get to speak to wonderful people like you. And I always learn something, which is why I do this. And I trust, my dear listener, that you have learned not just something, but many things. around forces, around the body, around perhaps the thinking around the impact of the body and the mind and how it all comes together. So if you haven't, do what I do with podcasts, hit replay, write notes. Yeah, write notes, grab what you need to know from this. And as always, you can hit me on the socials, let me know what your thoughts. If you've got questions for myself or for Tom, do connect. So there'll be links on the show notes and on socials this is on, so do connect. So Tom, thank you for your time, dear listener. Thank you for your time. Until the next one, take care. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please subscribe. And if a friend would benefit from hearing this, do send it on to them as well. If you would like to get in touch yourself, then you can go to my website, which is saljefferies.com, spelled SaljFferies, saljefferies.com. Hit the get in touch link, and there you can send me a direct message. If you'd like to go one step further and learn whether coaching can help you overcome a challenge or a block in your life, then do reach out and I offer a call where we can discuss how this may be able to help you. Until the next time, take care.